From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Thursday edition, today is National Religious Freedom Day. President Trump, just a little over an hour ago at the White House, announcing administrative actions that will protect the First Amendment. This is what he had to say.
That is why today my administration is issuing strong new guidance to protect religious liberty in our public schools. The right of students and teachers to freely exercise their faith will always be protected, including the right to pray.
There were two other major religious liberty policies that were announced today. The acting director of the Office of Budget and Management, Russ Vogt, is here to explain in just a moment. And last night, Republican lawmakers in the House held what's called a special order on the House floor as about three dozen lawmakers made speeches on the sanctity of human life. The special order comes in advance of next week's 47th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Ohio Congressman Bob Latta, who participated in the special order last night, will join me a little later in the program. This past October, in a speech at Notre Dame, Attorney General William Barr said, quote, ground zero for the attacks on religion are the schools. To me, he said, this is the most serious challenge to religious liberty, end quote. Well, today, President Trump put the atheist bullies on notice who are trying to deny children their right to pray or express their faith on school campuses. We'll talk about it with Eric Buehrer, president of Gateways to Better Education, a little later here on Washington Watch. And today, as we mark Religious Freedom Day at FRC, we wanted to again emphasize why protecting religion here in the United States is so important by drawing attention to religious persecution abroad. Johar Ilham, the daughter of an imprisoned Uyghur scholar, joins us with a horrifying account of religious persecution in China. All of that and more coming up on this Thursday edition of Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T Perkins. Let me remind you once again, coming up next weekend in Kernersville, North Carolina, our Stand Courageous Men's Conference will be there in North Carolina the following weekend, January the 31st and February the 1st. We'll be in Pensacola, Florida. Find out how you can be a part of that with General Jerry Boykin, Bishop Larry Jackson, myself, and Stu Weber. Go to TonyPerkins.com. Right, sitting in the Oval Office today, President Trump unveiled three major religious liberty policies that will protect religious organizations by ensuring they are treated fairly, something that has not always been the case in recent years. Also, reinforcing the freedom of public school students across the country to pray and express their religious beliefs on school campuses. This includes actions by White House Budget Director Russ Vogt that will hold agencies accountable for complying with President Trump's executive order preventing discrimination against faith-based organizations in the distribution of federal grants. Joining me now to talk about this is Russ Vogt himself. Russ, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me on your show, Tony. Good to talk with you, as always.
Well, you guys are pumping out some good stuff over there. Explain to our listeners the impact of the executive order today, the announcements by the administration, and what you're doing there in the Office of Budget Management.
Sure. I'll talk specifically to our individual piece and then speak more broadly to all the things the president signed today. Number one is that we put forward guidance to comply and require agencies to comply with the Supreme Court decision in Trinity Lutheran, which said that religious organizations in the state cannot be penalized by barring them from participating and competing for federal funds. So a lot of times you'll have a state that will receive a good chunk of money, and then they will then provide funding to other grant recipients. And it's important that those religious organizations, where they are competing, are not barred. The Supreme Court said that we're taking steps to link that court's decision up with the agencies to make sure the agencies are speaking very clearly to all the states and sub-grant recipients and to make sure they have these policies in place. And here's the issue. It's often hard hard to get people moving in the right direction. One of the things that will make people pay attention to these types of laws on the books is the fact that their funding is attached to it. And so we want to make sure that that is, if they're going to receive federal fundings, we want to make sure that religious organizations have just as the ability to compete for it if they have a program that will help Americans.
So I mean, that's basically the teeth, the enforcement. This is not just a feel-good policy. This is a policy that will actually affect behavior.
Exactly. That's our view. And then the other thing that the administration has done is to, in about nine different agencies, everyone from DOJ to HUD to HHS, is to remove the Obama administration regulations that really wanted to provide red tape on religious organizations by saying, hey, if you're coming to a religious organization, you've got to provide notice to the people coming through your doors that they can have an alternative provider, which is quite frankly offensive, and secondly provides bureaucratic red tape for them that costs them money and means that they can't provide as much care, and that we would also alleviate them from the need to refer to these other secular providers. Again, we don't have any issue with secular providers. We just want to make sure that religious organizations can compete without the same red tape being put on them. So another really important set of proposed rules that have gone out today throughout the federal government.
Russ Vogt, I want to go back for a moment. You made mention to the Trinity Lutheran case. I just want to make sure people understand what we're talking about here. We're not talking about favored treatment for religious organizations. In that particular case, you had a school that was a religious school, but they had the opportunity to participate in a program that allowed recycled tires to be used on playgrounds. And because there was like a subsidy provided by the state, and because they were a religious organization, even though taxpayers' children went to that school, they were denied access to that program. Is that right?
Those are the facts for sure. Yep.
And so what this is doing, what the court decided, the Supreme Court, and what the administration is doing is said, look, faith-based organizations treated like everybody else. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And that states need to have in their certification. So every time you have a grant, you have an agreement between the government and the grant recipient. Those requirements need to ensure that the religious organization is not being penalized in any way. And so those are the types of things that we're moving forward. And I think it will have a big effect. The last thing that the president unveiled today was an update of the guidance to schools that had not been updated since 2003 as it pertains to constitutionally protected prayer in schools for teachers and educators and coaches. We want to make sure that people know who are in schools that they have recourse to be able to appeal decisions that don't go their way by their local school board. Many of them don't. And those are also decisions that a local education agency needs to know. Eventually, their grant funding is impacted by it. So, again, we believe this is an updated guidance that will send the signal to students and educators across the country that you have the ability to practice your faith, not just in home, but in your schools and in your profession. And it's a signal to the education community, the school boards, and the agencies that are receiving federal funds, look, you have to make sure that these people are protected, and if there will be consequences eventually with your funding, which is significant if you don't.
Yeah, I want to make sure folks don't miss that point, because oftentimes we will see proclamations, declarations, we'll see laws passed, but no real teeth. The teeth here is that local agencies receiving federal education funding under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965 must certify in writing, so the onus is on them, to its state's educational agency that it has no policy that prevents or otherwise denies participation in constitutionally protected prayer in public schools, as detailed in this updated guidance. So essentially, Russ, what this does is puts the onus on the schools, those that would deprive students of their religious freedom, rather than the students.
That's exactly right. We want to make sure that you never have a Coach Joe Kenny who's the football coach that was praying silently on the 50-yard line and was fired as a result. And I'm sure you discussed that on this program when it happened.
I have a Marine gunnery sergeant. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I've discussed his case and had him on the radio a few times. I don't want people to miss the significance of this, because essentially what the Trump administration is doing is putting the atheist bullies on notice that no longer are they going to be able to push kids around and those administrators who want to exercise their First Amendment freedoms on school campuses.
That's exactly right. We want to make sure that people who are being, their religious freedoms are being impacted, know that the federal government is on their side and that there are opportunities to appeal those decisions and to have recourse.
Now, will the Department of Justice, as we see schools, if they fall in line, what recourse would those schools have if you have these atheist groups, these anti-faith groups coming after the schools based upon their falling in line with this federal guidance?
Yeah, no, I don't know the plans that the Attorney General has, although he is leading this charge with some of the commentary that he has put out with regard to Trinity Lutheran, and they're one of the agencies that putting forth this religious liberty regulations today. So, I think I'd be excited to figure out what he's got up in store to be able to carry this forward and to ensure that help is in the court system as well.
Well, I would imagine that he has both barrels loaded, given the statements that he has made. In fact, I just quoted, I think, earlier today in some remarks, his speech that he made before Notre Dame about religious freedom, and in particular, he said this: ground zero for these attacks on religion on the schools. To me, this is the most serious challenge to religious liberty. So I would imagine that he is ready to defend those who would defend constitutional rights.
I don't think you're wrong, Tony. I think you're onto something there.
Well, Russ Vogt, thanks so much for joining us today to give us a rundown on the latest. I think a very significant day as we celebrate National Religious Freedom Day. This administration, without question, is putting freedom back in Religious Freedom Day.
Thanks, Tony. Good to be on your show.
All right. Thanks so much. Russ Vogt, who is the director of the Office of Budget and Management there at the White House. And quite a significant day on religious freedom. The issue of the schools, one of the being nearest and dearest to my heart, because that's where they're indoctrinating our children and basically disarming them of their faith and marginalizing, stigmatizing children who try to exercise their First Amendment freedom. We're going to talk more about that a little later in the program. Eric Buehrer joins me. He was there at the White House earlier today. We're going to talk about what this means for classrooms across America. But coming up next, last night, Republican lawmakers, nearly three dozen of them, went to the House floor for a special order to talk about the sanctity of human life as we approach the 47th anniversary of the infamous Roe v. Wade decision. Ohio Congressman Bob Latta joins me next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Join FRC live via webcast for the 15th annual Pro-LifeCon Digital Action Summit. On January 24th from FRC's headquarters in Washington, you'll hear from political leaders, bloggers, journalists, and activists who will share how they view social media and other digital tools to further the pro-life message. You'll be empowered to better reach your own communities by learning best practices from those who are at the cutting edge of the digital pro-life movement. Tune in Friday, January 24th at 8 a.m. at ProLifeCon.com.
We all need to be lectured sometimes. Family Research Council's new podcast features selected talks by top thinkers from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast podium takes on tough issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Listen with us to the lecture, then stick around afterward as we break down the content. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Ever hear the term toxic masculinity? Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Masculinity is under attack in our culture. The American Psychological Association released guidelines declaring traditional masculinity ideology as harmful. Brown University, an Ivy League school, offered a course, Unlearning Toxic Masculinity, explaining that rigid definitions of masculinity are toxic to men's health. And a University of Texas class, Masculine UT, treated masculinity as if it were a mental health crisis. Thankfully, the culture does not have the last word on true masculinity. God does. Our Stand Courageous Men's conferences offer biblical solutions to the crisis of manhood. We seek to help men develop character, cultivate habits, build relationships, and make commitments that will move them closer to God's design. Check out StandCourageous.com for an event in your area. That's StandCourageous.com. One other trip to Israel. Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us on this Thursday afternoon. It has been 47 years since the U.S. Supreme Court declared it would determine America's policy on abortion by striking down state prohibitions and declaring elective abortions legal at any stage of pregnancy. Since then, over 60 million babies have lost their lives due to abortion in America. Last night, nearly three dozen pro-life lawmakers took to the House floor to draw attention to this atrocity. One of those lawmakers was Congressman Ralph Norman of South Carolina. Here's a short clip of what Congressman Norman had to say.
Just a few months ago, September 25th, our 17th grandchild was born 3 months premature. His name was Warren, and we were unsure if he would survive. But by the grace of God and the love and support of family and friends, the heroic work of the great doctors and nurses, that Warren is still with us today. After more than 100 days in the neonatal intensive care unit, Warren is finally able to leave the hospital last week. Each moment we spend with him is a true miracle. Warren was 1 pound, 15 ounces when he was born. And you can see the elements of his personality from the very beginning. He was a fighter. It's a daily reminder that the lives of millions of other children, the same size as Warren was when he was born, was allowed to be cut short due to the ruling of Roe versus Wade.
Joining me now is another member of the House who spoke on the floor last night, Congressman Bob Latta from Ohio's 5th Congressional District. Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony, thanks very much for having me on and for all that you're doing.
Well, thank you for helping draw attention to this issue of abortion, Roe v. Wade. Before we get into the substance of what you shared last night, just explain to our listeners what a special order is.
Well, a special order is after we finish our regular legislative business for the day, each party, the Republicans and Democrats, each get 1 hour. And so the Republicans used this hour with Chris Smith from New Jersey, who has been a pro-life fighter for decades, advocating for life, led that special order for an hour. And members can go down and speak during that time to really, again, express what we believe and what our faith is and what we have to do to protect life in this country.
You focused on one aspect of abortion in particular last night. Share that with our listeners.
Well, before I do, let me just say that you're absolutely right. When you talk about we've had 60 million abortions in this country, and I think people need to put this, and I said last night one thing, it's just not a statistic that you can think about, just let it go by. That's more than 20 million people that live in the state of California, and about 33 million more people that live in the state of Texas. That's how many lives have been lost. And what I focused on last night is a piece of legislation that I have. It's called the Save Moms and Babies Act, because, again, we've seen that since 2000, chemical abortions have been introduced in this country. About 39% of the abortions in this country in 2017 were chemical. And they're dangerous, because if some of these things would change, and what my legislation would make sure that it wouldn't, we want to prevent any labeling changes on these drugs. We don't want the FDA to approve any more abortion drugs. And we also don't want to have these providers dispensing these drugs remotely by mail or even telemedicine. So we want to make sure that no new drugs are approved, but we want to make sure that we stop this.
And I want folks to understand, we've talked about this on the program before, but that's where the abortion industry is headed. Planned Parenthood even developing an app where you can eventually, if they have their way, you'll be able to order these chemical abortions via mail through an app. So what you're doing is trying to get ahead of the trends that are out there that have obviously deadly consequences for the babies, but also consequences, health consequences, and complications for the mothers.
Well, and these have, as I mentioned, these have the highest concentration rate of emergency room visits. And the problem, when you're looking at it, with people, with a woman taking these, if they don't know where they are in their pregnancy, if they're having an ectopic-type pregnancy, they face very, very serious health care risk and even death. And so by saying that you can do this over the mail or telemedicine and getting it through an app is absolutely dangerous.
And we're seeing with surgical abortions declining. In fact, at about half of what it was in 1982 when it hit its high water mark, this is where they're going, and they're pushing this. What's the status of your legislation?
Well, it's just like with everything we do when we're talking about right to life. It's a tough issue in the United States House of Representatives. When you look at the Democrat control to get this bill heard, but I'm working on it. We want to make sure that it's out there. We have to make sure that people understand what it is. But at the same time, it's important that I think that we look back as how far we've come. And I just, with the Life March next week in Washington, I know that over 300 people from my district will be there. They'll drive in from Ohio, but tens and tens of thousands will be there, which the news media will not even cover. But I think all of those people have been on the front line. This, when we've had 862,000 abortions performed in 2017, and that's down, but we still remember that's more people that live in the state of South Dakota. All those babies that were aborted in 2017. So we've got to keep this out there, and we're doing everything possibly we can to take back the House to right. make sure that we get this legislation forward.
Well, I also think it's instructive for the states. We saw this about a decade ago when the Pain Capable Bill was introduced by my good friend Frank Tranks when he was in Congress and couldn't get anywhere in Congress. But states then took it up because members right. of Congress were modeling, setting an example. So that's exactly what you're doing with this legislation. Congressman Bob Lauder, thank you so much for joining us. And we do appreciate the work you're doing for the unborn on Capitol Hill.
And thank you for your work.
All right. Thanks so much. Find out more. Go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. By the way, there's information. We've been working with his team and others on Capitol Hill regarding these chemical abortions. FRC.org/chemical abortions. You can find out more about that. All right. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about the classroom and the intolerance that we're seeing from the left trying to drive religion from the public space. But the president pushing back, giving children the right to pray. That's next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away. This is Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us on this Thursday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is @TPerkins. Good day for religious freedom. I'm telling you, this administration, folks, I've got a list of these things that we're going to be continually, it's on the website, FRC Action, but we're going to continue to put this out, what this administration has done to restore religious freedom in this country. And today, as we mentioned earlier, the president made an announcement that the administration will protect religious organizations and reinforce the freedom of public school students across America to pray and express their religious beliefs. Now, this is important to me as a former Louisiana legislator. I'm the author of the current statute on the books as it pertains to prayer. This is a big deal. And the president really is basically putting the bullies of the left on notice. Mm. These atheist organizations are not going to be able to pick on the children of America anymore. The president is going to join them. Well, joining me is the president of Gateways to better Education, Eric Buehrer, with some practical methods that students will be able to utilize under these new rules. Eric, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, thanks so much. Good to be with you.
I should say welcome back to Washington Watch. let me, first off, I was talking to Russ Vogt earlier, and I made reference to William Barr's speech back in October at Notre Dame about the school being ground zero in the fight for religious freedom. Yeah. And, you know, the left basically attacking him for that. Jeffrey Toobin, who is a contributor, CNN, legal contributor, basically said, quote, "The heart of Barr's speech is devoted to a supposed war on religion in education." Is it a supposed war?
It really isn't. But we're fighting a battle against people who are simply ignorant of what the law actually says, what guidelines the Department of Education has put out. And so the challenge is to get this information into the hands of teachers and administrators, because they're so afraid of being attacked for allowing something, thinking that it's not allowed, but it is allowed. And so what we want to do is help the administrators and teachers say, no, this is actually okay. In fact, not only is it okay, it's good. We want students to be who they are and to express their faith in word and deed in our classrooms. Our grades will go up. Our behavior problems will go down. And so,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, the research we have here in the archives of FRC show that to be the case. So there's a little incentive here under the new rules put forth by the Trump administration for schools to do that, because this is now going to be linked to federal funding.
It is. They have to certify that they have no policy against prayer in the schools. That's kind of a low bar, because all you have to say is, well, I have no policy against it. That doesn't talk about how you practice.
Right.
And your practice could be very restrictive. But here's something. I was talking to Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos today, and she said the other thing that they've added is that any incident of religious discrimination that is reported to the school has to be reported to the Department of Education.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to go to the state, and then the state has to report it. And if it's not being done, that will jeopardize federal funding as well. So there's a reporting accountability. So it's not just, we don't have any policy. They also have to show, boy, we're getting a lot of complaints from this school district. Why?
Yeah, and I would imagine that the Department of Justice is also going to be focusing some attention on this. Department of HHS, very successful in their Office of Civil Rights,
yes,
protecting and providing a vehicle for people whose religious freedom, rights of conscience, have been violated. So this is a refreshing, encouraging, quite frankly, exciting step from this administration to take on what I agree with the Attorney General is ground zero in the battle over religious freedom.
Well, if you have a whole generation of young people from kindergarten through 12th grade that grow up thinking that somehow public expression of your faith in the world that they live in, the classroom, is forbidden, then it's no wonder they become adults who have that same thinking.
That is absolutely
right. We don't say Merry Christmas in the shopping malls and in the restaurants anymore, because that generation grew up all their lives hearing, oh, you can't say Merry Christmas.
It stigmatized religion and the expression of religion. That was by design.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of work to be done, but, you know, a journey of 100 miles begins with, 1,000 miles begins with a single step.
This was a big step.
It was a big step. Very quickly, Eric, almost out of time. Tell folks what Gateways to Better Education does.
Well, we equip Christians within the public schools to teach about the Bible and Christianity and create a faith-friendly environment. We've actually set up a web page specifically to promote what we call the Free to Speak campaign. So if you went to gogateways.org/free to speak, you'll get all the documentation, information, videos, things that you can do in your classrooms, in your churches to promote religious liberty with students.
All under the law.
Absolutely. All within the law. People think that the law is very restrictive. It's actually very open. It's just that people think it's restrictive, and that's the problem.
And now we have an administration that is saying, this is the law, this is what we're going to operate under, and this outlines the freedoms that our teachers and our students have, and we're going to protect them.
It's a new day.
Eric, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate all the work that you do.
Thank you.
All right, folks, there's still more Washington Watch to come. Here at the Family Research Council earlier today, and we took the focus on international religious freedom because we want to draw attention to what's happening abroad, to warn Americans what could happen here if we take our freedom for granted. When we come back, we're going to be talking with the daughter of a Uyghur who's been imprisoned for his faith in China. That's next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at FRCblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at FRCblog.com.
A strong case can now be made that China has become one of the most totalitarian states in human history. The Chinese Communist Party restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale, targeting those of every faith, especially Christians, Muslims, Tibetan Buddhists, and Falun Gong. The Chinese Communist Party's movement against religion has had and continues to have devastating consequences for those who simply wish to live according to their conscience. The Chinese Communist Party's consistent abuses of human rights prove that it cannot be treated just like any other country. The United States must address these human rights and religious freedom violations in their trade and diplomatic dealings with China. For more information about the human rights crisis in China, visit frc.org/China. That's frc.org/China.
In the U.S., the rate of chemical abortions is at an all-time high. This increase is being driven by the abortion industry, which wants abortion pills available through the pharmacy in the mail, making do-it-yourself abortions the future of the abortion industry. Abortion advocates once claimed that legal abortion would prevent back-alley abortions, but the health complications that often result from chemical abortion are eerily similar to those of back-alley abortions. For more information, visit frc.org/chemical-abortion. Last year, my brother Josh, a 37-year...
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us on this Religious Freedom Day. That's right. As we mentioned earlier in the program, today is Religious Freedom Day in the United States, a day in which we commemorate January the 16th, 1786. That was when Virginia enacted the Statute for Religious Freedom, which set forth the principle that religious liberty is an inherent right. It's not a gift from the state. It is given to us by God and to be guarded by the state. That was authored by Thomas Jefferson, and it served as the inspiration, really the model, for the legal architecture of the conscience protections that we find today in the First Amendment that was adopted in the Bill of Rights in 1789. Now, it was drafted by James Madison. Well, this constitutional history is hugely significant to us as Americans. We recognize the responsibility we have to advance religious freedom globally, and we have an understanding of the importance of it. In fact, after World War II, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the United Nations, there was put forth the fact that religious freedom, in Article 18, is a human right. And since then, we have been working to advocate and to protect that freedom around the globe. In fact, as I have the privilege of serving as chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, that is our mission, is to promote religious freedom. And not as, again, not as an American right, but as a human right. Now, this is one of the reasons that the Family Research Council is so focused on this, both internationally and domestically, because the two interlinked. And today we decided to focus internationally on the unprecedented attacks against this fundamental right in China. And you hear us talking about this on the program quite a bit. But the most prominent example of China's harsh crackdown on religious freedom is its program of repression against Uyghurs. Now, this is a traditionally Muslim ethnic group. China has incarcerated, according to some reports, somewhere between 1 to 3 million Uyghurs who are guilty of no crime other than maintaining a distinct religious and cultural identity. Well, earlier today, we had the honor of hearing from Johar Ilham, who is familiar with the tragic consequences of China's crackdown. She is the daughter of Ilham Toti. He is a well-known Uyghur scholar who sought to promote reconciliation between the Han Chinese and the Uyghurs there in China. In 2014, he was sentenced to life imprisonment for his work, and he remains in prison as a prisoner of conscience. I'm glad to have Johar here in the studio with me now, along with Travis Weber, Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs here at FRC. Johar, Travis, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Well, you did a great job talking earlier today at the Family Research Council when you had a lecture, which, by the way, folks, you can see. You can watch the whole thing online. Go to TonyPerkins.com, and it's all archived there. But for our listeners, Johar, would you just explain your father's situation? What happened, and where is he today?
Okay. Yesterday was actually the 6th year anniversary of my father, Ham Tohti, being arrested for his peaceful academic and expressive activities. 2013, February 2nd, was the last time I saw my father. We were at the Beijing International Airport. We were planning to come to the United States. For me, it was my winter break for my school. And for my father, he was invited as a visiting scholar for a one-year program. He was arrested at the airport. I was only a teenager, so the security staff at the airport let me leave. My father was kept and released after 3 days. During that 3 days, he was questioned, beaten, threatened. Soon after his release, he was set under house arrest for 11 months until 2014, January 15th. My father was taken away from home. He disappeared for a month. Then when we heard about him, we knew he was charged as a separatist and extremist. And soon, a few months after, he was sentenced to life. I haven't been able to speak to my father since then. Since 2017, which was the last time my family members were able to visit him from prison, and 2017 was the last time we were able to hear about him. We don't even know if he's still alive. Before he was arrested, he spent years just to advocate for Uyghur people's rights and also other ethnic minorities' rights inside China by writing articles on his own blogs on the website uyghurbiz.com, and also by accepting interviews, meeting with other countries' government officials, ambassadors, in order to seek for help. But Chinese government thought it was a threat and thought my father was trying to challenge their power, but my father was not. He was simply just trying to be a bridge between Han Chinese and the Uyghur people, and he was trying to be a fixer, to fix the problem between the Han Chinese and the other ethnic minorities, including Uyghur people.
Convicted of being a separatist, that would suggest that somehow he was working to overthrow the government, and that is not at all what your father was doing.
My father had never, ever mentioned of overthrowing the government and also were separating the country. In fact, he has been suggesting on building schools, building hospitals. Suggestions like this should never be linked to a separatism act. It's actually, my father was actually that exact person a government should be willing to work with. My father was a well-known scholar, and he was focused on economy, sociology, and his researchers were very well-known in China. Despite the fact that in China, Uyghur scholars were always not very acknowledged well, but my father was well-known because of his efforts on his academic career, but also his human rights activist activism life.
So, Johar, how widespread is this repression, persecution of Uyghurs and other religious people in China?
It's not only happening to the Uyghurs. So far, according to the UN report, we have more than 1 million Uyghur people who are locked up in concentration camps. According to the Chinese government, it's so-called re-education camps and it's re-education centers, and it's meant to train people for their for skills and jobs. But who do we have in those camps? Professors, high school teachers,
right,
and soccer players, comedians.
All kinds of
people who are successful in their careers. And those people do not need vocational training or job training. And not only to Uyghurs, but also Christians. And the churches have been shut down, and also Tibetan Buddhists. It's happening to all also non-religious groups like human rights lawyers. It's happening. It's spread to everywhere in China.
Travis, the Trump administration, specifically the Department of State, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, has put a fine point on focusing on China and the abuses that have taken place there.
They have, Tony. And as Johar knows, she's been part of those presentations at the State Department and what the Trump administration has been announcing. But we've had a lot of consistent, positive messaging statements from State Department, including Ambassador Lars Brownback, who went to Hong Kong and spoke about China last year.
Right.
Today, Tony, the administration's Religious Freedom Day announcement states that repressive governments persecute religious worshipers using high-tech surveillance, mass detention, and torture. Well, that obviously is a reference to China in addition to other places. So we've blacklisted companies focused on this issue in the larger U.S. relationship. So there's a lot of good effort. We need to keep that effort going because, as I was mentioning earlier in the day, we're in a battle of ideas and values. And just like we battled the Soviet Union throughout the 20th century, with a different understanding of relationship between the government, the civil authorities, and the church, we're in a similar struggle now. China does not look at the religious institutions and religious communities with the same respect and understanding of that relationship and autonomy that we do historically and which we must continue to fight for. So this is a mega struggle, and we have to continue it.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us on this Thursday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at T Perkins. In studio with me, Johar Ilham and Travis Weber, Vice President of Policy here at the Family Research Council. Johar, I was in New York, the United Nations, when President Trump made the historic speech on religious freedom, first time a president's ever done that. And you were there. And I was impressed with your presentation, how you spoke to this issue. I want to ask you, what brought you to this point? I mean, you're pretty public out there speaking to this, and you know, with all that's happening in China and the communist regime there and their tentacles reaching far and wide, what brought you to a point of this public advocacy for not only your father but for the Uyghur people?
Mm-hmm. It took me a lot of time to decide and to make me become to go this far. 6 years ago, when I first decided to speak up for my father's situation, I only wanted to speak up for my father, and I did not want to get into all the politics and all the others because I thought I wasn't the best person to speak up, and I didn't think I was knowledgeable enough to educate people on the issue, but as a daughter, I knew that I'm the best person, perfect person to speak, and because I know my father the most. But since 2 years ago, I have decided to expand my activities, not only to focus on my father, but also for the Uyghur communities, and not only the Uyghur communities, but also other ethnic minorities who are also suffering from the Chinese government's regime. Why is that? It's not that I think I'm an expert now. It's not that I think I am so knowledgeable about it now. It's because one of the reasons is because the people who can educate people on this issue better than me are locked up in concentration camp or sent to prison now. That's one of the reasons. And there aren't many people overseas. Most of them have family members who are still in China who probably locked up in concentration camp or prisons. They're living in fear. I am afraid, too. I am so scared that my actions could bring negative influence to my rest of my family members. In fact, one of my cousins has been sentenced to 10 years for having my father's photo and his article in her phone. And it's very common nowadays, and this is one of the reasons. This is so common that I feel this is sick, and this is not supposed to be happening. And it's not about one person, it's not about one group, it's not about Uyghur people anymore, it's about humanity. And does human rights violation supposed to be exist in 2020, like such a violation should supposed to be exist in 2020. It shouldn't. And aren't we all supposed to speak up? Aren't we all supposed, no matter if I'm Uyghur or not, and no matter if I'm, if someone is from other countries, from other religious group or other ethnic groups, aren't we supposed to stand up for atrocities like this, to against this atrocity? Aren't we supposed to fix this? This is a problem. When we see a problem, aren't we all supposed to fix it?
Well, I commend you, Johar, for your courage and boldness to speak out. I'm certain your father would be proud of you for being so bold. And speaking to a problem that, as you have just described, is so profound and reaches to all people. And in the year 2020, we would think it wouldn't be happening. But in fact, it seems to have, seems to be getting worse. Because I think primarily because of the silence of too many people for too long. And speaking of that, Travis Weber, let me bring you back into the conversation, because some might be saying it's Religious Freedom Day, National Religious Freedom Day. Why are you focusing on China? There is a direct correlation between international and domestic religious freedom.
There is, Tony. And to Johar's point, we have the freedom to speak out and defend our rights right now. We must use it. We must use it to defend the Uyghurs and others in China, defend others being persecuted around the world, and defend those suffering adverse repression, adverse consequences here at home. We have that freedom. The link is, we understand religious freedom conceptually as the freedom to choose and live out one's faith, regardless of what that is, anywhere in the world. So we must continue to fight for that here at home in certain practices and laws, certain areas, and internationally, like in China. Tony, that's something that we at FRC see played out, that one principle plays out in different contexts, and we have the freedom to speak. We must use it while we have it.
That's right. We must use our freedom for those who do not have it. Johar, thank you so much for being with us today. And Travis, thank you for joining us in the studio as well. And folks, I want to thank you for joining us on this National Religious Freedom Day as we focus on the importance of America's religious freedom to the rest of the world. And I want to challenge you to be praying for people around the world, like Johar's father and others who are imprisoned for their faith. And speak out for them. Folks, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234.